Today, I want to whet your appetite a little bit with the conversation about the outskirts of the Roman Empire. That's where most of the opposition to the empire could be found. That's where it was its fiercest. And we're going to focus specifically on Great Britain. In fact, the name Britain comes from the Roman Latin term Britannia. And for that conversation, I spoke to Adrian Goldsworthy. Adrian Goldsworthy is a scholar of the Roman Empire. He's the author of the book Hadrian's Wall. This is the wall that could be found in northern England, and this was the furthermost western expansion of the Roman Empire. And then on the other side, you would have what they would call barbarians, the Celtic tribes. And so I spoke to Adrian Goldsworthy just a couple of weeks ago, and we did it via Skype. Goldsworthy, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell me about the world that the Roman Empire found, that Julius Caesar, I guess, found when he first arrived on the island, which today we call Great Britain?
It's something that, I mean, Caesar only really reached the southeast, and what he talks about probably only applies to that area. Linguistically, these are people who are speaking Celtic languages. These days, it's not very fashionable for the archaeologists to view all Celts as very similar in terms of culture and organization. The Greeks and the Romans present them that way. They tend to describe them as all having, you know, the same sort of tribal structure. They have chiefs, they have kings, they have high kings over them. The tribes are always fighting each other. They're headhunters. You know, they take people's heads as trophies and display them on their buildings. They do human sacrifice. They get up to all sorts of things like that. There's a mixture. There's a variation. Warfare does appear to be very, very common in Britain, as it was in most of Iron Age Europe, and you're basically dealing with that culture. But there are a lot of problems in that some areas we have a rather poor archaeological record for what's going on. It's one of those drawbacks that often the best finds archaeologically, when people are living in quite simple round houses, you might find post holes of the houses, but the objects you find tend to be with grave goods. If they bury somebody and put things in the grave, the problem is if you then have a culture or a tribe who doesn't bury anybody, but perhaps like some of the Native American peoples, exposes the bodies on platforms, that's going to leave almost no archaeological trace whatsoever. So there are areas of Britain where we really don't know too much about the people, other than broadly, this is the sort of pottery they're using, this is the sort of metalwork they're using, and they live in these round houses. And that sort of material is quite hard to date. One thing that is important to remember, not just about Britain, but about the whole Roman Empire, is that wherever the Romans go, many of the locals welcome them. And there are many tribes, leaders, kings and queens who never, ever fight against Rome. Instead, they see the Romans as a big, powerful friend to protect them against the neighboring tribe and the neighboring peoples against whom they've been fighting for generations. And they've got those sorts of grudges that have been about cattle raiding and tribal problems and disputes and warfare for generations, perhaps centuries. That's far more important to you than this strange foreign empire that appears and, generally speaking, doesn't interfere too much in your daily life. However, although the Romans don't consciously interfere because they're really too lazy and they don't have a big administrative system, they like people to become more like them. So they encourage the aristocracy to live in Roman villas, to start speaking Latin, they give them Roman citizenship and then try and encourage them to buy into the imperial system, have a career in it, and also start being local magistrates, local priests, all the things the Romans understand. The Romans really understand cities and city life, and that's the way they'd like to view the world. In Britain, you have some towns and cities, but especially in the north, people just don't seem to like living in that sort of environment. So you end up with lots of little settlements around the country, but they still start to become more Roman. And, you know, there you have a currency. You can see in sites on Hadrian's Wall and around it that luxury goods and quite ordinary goods from hundreds, even thousands of miles away in other parts of the empire are readily available to quite ordinary people. Very, very quickly, this becomes part of the major imperial economy. And goods are moving around, people are moving around, and it's much harder to trace them archaeologically, but probably ideas, maybe even jokes and songs and tunes are moving around. because this is a far more cosmopolitan world than anything that had happened in the Iron Age before, when people generally didn't move around so much.
I guess beyond the archaeological record, everything we've learned, whether it be about the Celtic tribes in what we call today Great Britain, I guess Britain itself is a Latin term, or even throughout areas around Germany and France today, everything that we know about these people comes from Roman historians or Roman writers themselves.
Yes, that's the problem. You're dealing with, in the Iron Age peoples, these are not literate cultures, so they don't leave any records. The closest you get are some of the poems that are not written down until the early Middle Ages in Ireland, where you have a very similar tribal organization. You've got things like the Ulster Cycle, the Tales of Cú Chulainn, and the Toyne, the Cattle Raid of Cooley, the central sort of epic of this cycle of stories about heroes who ride in chariots, who chop off each other's heads and keep them as trophies, who have very powerful queens, who seem to be quite similar to the impression we get of the Celts described by the Greeks and Romans. And that's about the only time where you maybe just get a glimpse, albeit one written down centuries later, of their own view of this world. But otherwise, it's deeply frustrating, is that when you simply have artifacts, and when you have burials, and when you have settlements, to understand the stories of these people, how they thought, what this meant to them, is almost impossible, because all of that has gone, all that oral tradition. We don't know the tribal names that appear for groups like the Brigantes in northern Britain, or the Iceni in Norfolk, in the southeast. These are names written down by the Romans or by the Greeks, and we don't know to what extent someone would have actually identified themselves as a member of that tribe. Was the tribe the most important thing? Was it your family? Was it some clan, some section within it? All of that, all the detail, all of the things that they would have taken for granted, we simply don't know. So we're guessing at what we think was probably there, but very hard to say precisely how it worked and what it meant to people.
If most tribes welcomed the Roman Empire, then why did the empire stop where Hadrian's Wall is? And I realize it went further for a short period of time and then receded again to where Hadrian's Wall is. Why didn't it continue going north through up through to Ireland?
It's one of those strange things in that, again, it's a problem is that we don't know as much about Roman Britain at all as we would like. There are some tribes that are very hostile and fight the Romans for a long period, although all those south of the wall eventually submit, and there's no real evidence for rebellions against Rome. The last one in southern Britain is in AD 60, when Queen Boudica burns down what would become London, and a couple of other major towns. But when that's defeated, there appears to be no repeat of it at all. On the other hand, Roman Britain always has what seems to be a disproportionately big garrison. The Roman army is a professional army, which means it's very expensive. Now, no government likes spending money when it doesn't have to. The other thing we have to remember with Roman emperors is that not only was the army expensive, and it is the single, by far the biggest element within the imperial budget, but the Roman army also poses a threat to emperors, because very few emperors will get killed by a foreign enemy. Even the Persians in the east, the great empire there, managed to defeat and kill only a couple of them. Particularly from the 3rd century AD onwards, and it's always a threat before that, the Romans fight civil war after civil war, when Roman soldiers proclaim their general as a leader, as a new emperor, and go off and fight rival emperors. And this happens there from 218 AD onwards, right to the end of the Roman Empire in the West in the late 5th century. There are only 3 decades without a civil war. This is something that just goes on and on and on. So it means that concentrating a lot of soldiers in one place is actually a big risk to the emperor. So it's really something that on every grounds they don't want to do. And yet, Britain has one of the biggest armies in the entire empire. And it keeps a very large army right the way through its history. So there's obviously a reason why. There is a military problem there as far as the Romans are concerned. And it looks as if the wall and this garrison is one way of one approach to dealing with this problem. In the 80s AD, the Romans march right up to almost the very north of Scotland. They don't quite go to the tip. However, they do parts of the Roman navy, sails around the top of Scotland. They visit some of the islands, probably the Orkneys. And it's only at that point the Romans are absolutely convinced and prove that Britain is an island. They weren't sure. They didn't know whether it may have been a continent, that it just went on and on. On at least one occasion, they talk about intervening in Ireland, and there are princes or kings, exiles from Ireland, who come to them, ask for help to be reinstated in power. That, as far as we can tell, never happens. They occupy northern Scotland. They build a legionary fortress up there in the 80s AD, and within a few years, abandon it. And they abandon this complicated line of outposts, of turrets, of towers, all on the edge of the Scottish Highlands, controlling all the glens, all the valleys that went through that area. So at that point, they've obviously thought about, well, let's occupy virtually all of the island. Within a few years, there's a crisis on the Danube, troops are needed elsewhere, the garrison of Britain is reduced, troops go back. And that's the time when they drop back to the frontier line that will become Hadrian's Wall a generation or so later. So I think they've wondered about it, but it's almost a sort of accountancy problem. It's a cost and profit balance, because if they're going to control that area, they'll need a lot of soldiers. But if they put a lot of soldiers up there, the soldiers are expensive, the revenue they get in terms of taxation is going to be quite poor, because this is not a wealthy area. There aren't a lot of mineral resources out there. The population isn't that huge. Although some parts of southern Scotland are very well cultivated in this period, nevertheless, this is not a spectacularly wealthy part of even compared to the rest of Roman Britain. So I think there's a decision that how do we best dominate this area? Because it's vital to remember that Hadrian's Wall is built as a barrier to other people coming south. It's never meant as a barrier to the Romans. There are outpost forts beyond the wall for most of its history. And the Roman army intervenes very far to the north whenever it wants to. Diplomatically, the Roman presence is clearly there as well. And we can see this in hordes of Roman silver coins that have been buried quite far up in northern Scotland, are presumably gifts to kings, to chieftains, to stay friends with Rome, not to cause a problem. It's a fairly traditional way of empires. You know, you use force, but you also use bribery to keep anybody happy. And what's quite interesting is that this clearly up here is not a monetary economy. You know, these are not coins that somebody spends. They are simply valuable almost as bullion for the leaders. So this is silver, this is gold that I can show off how rich, how powerful I am, and I can give out as gifts, or that I can simply afford to bury in hordes of 300 or more coins and leave to be discovered by archaeologists 2,000 years later. So all the way through, this is a sort of ongoing pattern. The problem is we just don't know enough about the changing balance of power between the tribes, the rise and fall of individual leaders, which ones are hostile, which ones are friendly, which ones vary between the two. We get glimpses of this in the sources. There are clearly changes at the end of the 2nd century, beginning of the 3rd century, which prompts the Emperor Septimius Severus himself to come to Britain with a major army and campaign again quite far to the north of Scotland and build some bases that are occupied at least for a decade or so before they're abandoned. So there are different ways of dealing with the problem. And almost certainly the military problem, the political problem the Romans are dealing with also changes. It's just that we don't have the accounts to tell us what's really going on. We're just guessing.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Adrian Goldsworthy. Adrian Goldsworthy is a renowned historian of the classical world. He's the author of a number of books on the Roman Empire, and we're talking about his book, Hadrian's Wall. Adrian Goldsworthy, I hope you'll indulge me here to go off topic a little bit, but I feel like I just have to ask you to tell us the story of Queen Boudica.
Right.
And I say because she sacks London, which is Londinium, and that's where it's a Latin term, and that's where we get the word London from.
Yeah, and there's a settlement of beginning as merchants. It's always a commercial city, which is quite interesting, on the River Thames. Some of them may well be there even before the Romans arrive, and certainly within years of the Roman occupation, this is flourishing as a town. Because you have to remember, the Romans have only landed in Britain in AD 43. Boudicca is 17 years later, in AD 60. And she's part of a tribe that have welcomed the Romans, that haven't fought them. Her husband is King Prasutagus, who's an ally of the Roman people, but he dies in AD 60. Now, something that's clearly happened and happens in a lot of provinces is that as the Roman army arrives, so do the bankers, so do the moneylenders, so do the people telling you how they'll give you lots and lots of money and you won't have to pay it back for a long time and you can spend it on all these luxury items that the empire offers. You can start to show off just how very Roman you are. And, you know, don't worry about the payments. We'll sort that out later as the interest builds up. You're introducing a whole system of loans and exchange that's completely unfamiliar to the locals. And we know that Seneca, one of the Emperor Nero's major advisors, who later will be forced to commit suicide because Nero turns against him, he's got huge investments in Britain in this way. So it's seen as a sort of big money-making opportunity. Now, when the king dies, Boudicca hopes that her daughters will be able to inherit as queens of the tribe. The problem is, in Roman law, the status of an allied king doesn't actually allow him, except unless it's a special, special privilege, to bequeath his throne to anybody. So Prasutagus makes his daughters and Nero joint heirs. The Romans interpret this as simply, well, you know, it's a gift to the emperor, it's up to the emperor to decide what's going to happen. Unfortunately, as is so often the case when you get these meetings between different cultures, many of the men on the spot are the worst possible people to choose for this situation. You know, you think some of the commissioners sent out to deal with the plains tribes before the Sioux uprising and this sort of thing. They're the people who are going to make things worse. And in this case, the blame is passed by the Romans onto a procurator, a financial official, the man who helped the emperor collect taxes in that region, who goes to Boudicca's capital somewhere in Norfolk and demands money instantly. He demands repayment also of all these debts that the king's run up. When Boudicca resists at being treated this way, he has her publicly flogged, her daughters are raped by his officials. You know, it's a really nasty, savage incident, which unsurprisingly outrages Boudicca, who, say, up until now has been an ally of Rome. And so the people, you know, they've thought of the Romans as friends. Suddenly they're being treated in this appalling way. So the anger from that blends with other anger. The neighboring tribe, who were never particular friends of the Iceni, have had part of their land confiscated to build a settlement for Roman veteran soldiers, discharged soldiers who are given a farm, have often taken local wives, and who settle down in the province at a place called Canulodonum. Again, people who've come in as conquerors aren't necessarily the most tactful neighbors, and particularly when they've taken your property. So there's a lot of hatred there. It all comes together. It's an interesting pattern that usually within about a generation of the conquest of an area by Rome, there is a major, major rebellion. And if that's defeated, on the whole, things go calmer. So one of the reasons is that within that generation, you've had enough time for young warriors to grow up who never fought the Romans. So, you know, they haven't seen what the Roman army is like and just how formidable and how strong the empire is. And they're keen to prove themselves. And you add in some of these acts of unnecessary brutality on the part of the Roman government. This is not how an official is supposed to behave. The Romans condemn him, but on the other hand, he clearly thought he could get away with it. Boudicca raises a very big army. She burns down Canulodonum first, massacres everybody there. She moves on to Londinium. This hasn't even got any walls to protect it, wasn't thought necessary. The Roman army at this stage is away in the west of the province, fighting just off the coast of North Wales. They've destroyed the center of the Druidic cult. So again, you've probably got a religious element to all this. The established religion of the tribes has suddenly been thrown into chaos by the Romans. So, you know, there's an element of sort of almost apocalyptic fears about all of this, that everyone, this is a very nervous time, and it just explodes into this incredibly brutal rebellion. Because in Londinium, again, Boudicca and her army massacre everybody. And bear in mind, most of the occupants of these towns, yes, they're civilians, but also very many of them are Romans. And they move on to the tribal capital of Verulanium, modern-day St. Albans, of the Atrebates, another allied tribe. So again, they're massacring fellow Britons, but ones who've sided with the Romans. Some tribes stay loyal to Rome, some defect and join Boudicca. There are stories very quickly of these really nasty atrocities of torture, of mutilation, of all sorts of things. And it's one of those rare occasions where the Roman army, the Roman soldiers, get really angry as well. Normally, all ancient warfare is brutal, but there's an element of sort of self-interest in the way they fight. But in the confrontation with Boudicca's rebels, when the army comes back from North Wales, and even though hugely outnumbered, manages to choose a good location and meets Boudicca and her rebels in battle, the Romans win, but not only do they win, they massacre everyone they can catch. And they start even killing the animals, the mules, the horses that the Britons had had with them. Now, normally you take prisoners because, brutal though it is, in the ancient world, human life has a value because you can sell people as slaves. So it isn't in the soldiers' interest to go and slaughter everybody. But on this occasion, they do that. And it's almost unprecedented. They never really, they're clearly both terrified and extremely angry. So you end up with a situation where the savagery sort of spirals out of control and gets worse and worse on each side as everybody does something terrible and then the other side matches it with something worse and so on and so on. Boudicca vanishes. She's defeated, and we don't really know what happens to her. It's said that she died soon afterwards. One source says maybe she took poison, perhaps she was ill. We don't really know what happened to her. We don't know what happened to her daughters. Significantly, her tribe, the Iceni, never seemed terribly prosperous throughout the rest of the history of Roman Britain. You know, they're okay. There are people there. They farm. They get on with things. But compared to the wealth they'd had before, it never really recovers. And something else that's quite strange happens, because the Roman governor who's put down the rebellion is replaced less than a year later. And the official reason is the loss of some warships in a storm. But according to our main source, that's written by the Senator Tacitus, he's actually replaced because he was considered to be too brutal, that he'd got to the point where he hated the Britons so much that he couldn't be an effective governor. So it's, although there's a grim, really nasty story of coercive, vicious imperialism with Boudicca, you also get the reminder that the Romans, you know, they don't think this is how you should behave. This is clearly when things go wrong. Yes, they're the masters. Yes, they're the conquerors. But actually, they want to treat people fairly well because they want people to be happy, because they really don't want them to rebel. Rebellions are dangerous. They're expensive. There was a genuine fear at this point that the province would be lost. But because of that one battle where Boudicca's defeated, it crumbles. And then over the next months, the rebellion is put down pretty brutally. So it's one of those stories. Boudicca, the name, probably came from the goddess of victory, Buddha. So it meant Victoria, basically. So it's one of those things in the 19th century under Queen Victoria, she was promoted as a heroine of Britain. And there's a statue of her riding her chariot outside the Houses of Parliament to this day that was put up in that period. So again, she's one of those figures that gets used and reused and turned into a story. But we don't know too much about the real person. And when you look at the history, it seems, you know, it's pretty brutal. It's not very flattering for anybody on either side.
Do you think that then the conditions that led to the rebellion, maybe not perhaps the rebellion or as big as the rebellion would be or grandiose as it would all become, but the conditions that at least led to the rebellion was a similar experience throughout Great Britain with the Roman Empire, and perhaps, and I know oftentimes we don't know for sure a lot when we talk about this, the ancient world, we have to speculate sometimes, but perhaps the people beyond Hadrian's Wall heard about this and sort of fortified their opposition to the expansion of the Roman Empire?
It could be. I mean, the arrival of the Romans, if you don't welcome them, can be a really unpleasant experience. You know, this is the ancient world where, as I say, if you get captured in war, you'll be sold as a slave. If you're lucky, you might end up fighting to the death in the arena. And, you know, nobody wants a load of foreigners coming in and telling them what to do. However, again, you've got to remember, when Boudicca rebels, some tribes join her, others stay loyal, which again rather suggests, well, two things. One is that life wasn't actually too bad for those people. But also, there is very little fellow feeling of one tribe to another. And that the Romans often are a more acceptable friend and ally than another tribe in Britain. So I think the story of Boudicca is that it shows when things go wrong. After all, Boudicca didn't want to be a rebel. You know, she didn't want to fight the Romans. She's just so badly mistreated by them that she's left, she gets to the point where there is no other alternative. You know, what do you do when you've been abused to that extent? What have you got left other than to try and fight? But mostly that doesn't happen, because most Roman officials are better than that, in part because, you know, the emperor will try and punish people. He doesn't want people to do that. I mean, there's a famous quote from the Emperor Tiberius, comes from a bit earlier than Roman Britain, where he talks about his governors and says, you know, I want you to shear my flock, not flay them alive. You know, don't skin them, just take off the wool so we can take off more wool next year and next year and next year. The Romans run their empire for a profit. It isn't profitable if people are forced into poverty, if they're also so desperate that they're going to rebel against you. So I think in the main, things are much better than that. Boudicca is a sign of things going wrong, and there isn't a rebellion like that after AD 60 for the next 350 years in lowland Britain, which suggests the Romans are getting it right, that even if people don't necessarily like them, that life is tolerable compared to the alternative. You know the risks of rebellion, you know how bad it can be. So, you know, okay, this is not too bad, I can put up with this. Quite a lot of people actually do extremely well under the Roman system and become far more prosperous, far better off. So, you know, a lot of them are becoming Roman citizens. So they buy into it. It may be that people in the north, you know, are aware that the Romans are coming thinking, well, we're offering civilization and all this sort of thing. And they look at it and think, well, I don't think much of that. I prefer to stay as I am. Thank you very much. There's clearly not large parts of northern Britain beyond the wall that wants to be Roman. You know, there might be allies, but they're definitely not encouraging the Romans to come in and rule them. But also the population there is much more scattered. It's much lower. The advantages are probably getting a little bit less certain. However, there is one telltale truth that isn't just the case in Britain, but throughout the Roman Empire in the West. And that's, if you leap to the end and go to the 5th century AD, when Roman administration in Britain ends round about 410 AD. Elsewhere in Gaul, modern-day France, Spain, it goes on a bit longer, but by the end of the 5th century, it's gone everywhere. In none of those provinces do you have an independence movement of people who want to be Britons or Gauls or Spanish. Which, if you compare that to the 20th century empires in Africa, in Asia, all the independence movements, say, you know, Gandhi in India, the different leaders in Africa and elsewhere, you know, who wanted to be free, they wanted to be independent. As the Roman Empire falls apart, everybody's still desperate to be Roman because the Romans have just been there so long. You know, it's 350, 60 years in Britain. It's even longer in places like Gaul. No one can remember a time before Rome, and none of the barbarian groups that are coming in are really offering anything that's more appealing. So all your identity has become, and the sense of civilization, of a comfortable life, of peace, is tied up with being Roman. So in Britain, as elsewhere, over time, people just get used to the idea. They accept it as normal. You know, it's very hard. In fact, by the end, by the 5th century, it's difficult for people to imagine a world without Rome, even though it will fairly soon fall to pieces. So I think there are warnings from how the Romans behave. And certainly, you know, the Romans can be deeply provocative. They can be cruel. They do exploit. However, you've got to balance it. They are, in the end, quite pragmatic. And they are really doing this for, you know, it's another, slightly as a digression, but if you go back to the Emperor Augustus in the beginning of the 1st century AD, poets like Horace and others are trying to tell him, go and conquer Britain, go and complete what Julius Caesar started. This will be great for the glory of Rome. The emperor doesn't do it. And one source writing soon afterwards says, well, you know, we looked at how much it would cost in terms of the garrison we need for Britain. And we thought that's not going to be actually profitable compared to the revenue we're going to get there. So it's better for us to levy tolls on goods coming from Britain when they reach the continent and the empire, and just have allies in Britain and sort of send diplomatic missions. So, you know, the whole decision to conquer Britain in the first place was probably one that went against pragmatism, but was necessary for the glory of the emperor. And the empire does sort of expand or not expand rather like that, depending on the politics internally. So it's quite complicated on both sides.
I find that interesting. And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, about the Roman Empire in general, and it did expand at times and receded at times, but mostly stayed about the same. The most imperial conquest happened when Rome was what we'd still consider to be a republic.
Yes, that's very much the case. And it's particularly in the last century or so of the Republic's history when it moves from the Mediterranean world and just sort of, it seems almost to explode. And Julius Caesar will push up to the Atlantic coast in Gaul, modern day France. They'll complete the conquest of Spain. There's a last burst of conquest under the first emperor, Augustus. You know, he's the fellow who's defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra to make himself sole ruler of the empire. But there's no coincidence that really expansion stops after his death. He gives the Romans a few decades of continuous conquest, continuous victory to show that we're not fighting each other in civil wars anymore. We're going out, we're making Rome strong, we're making Rome safe against external threats, all this sort of thing. I'm giving you all this glory, isn't it wonderful? But there's no coincidence that men like Julius Caesar and his opponent Pompey the Great, others like Sulla and Marius, that the leaders in Rome's civil war that tore the Republic apart to the extent where the system failed and you ended up, people welcomed the certainty offered by someone like Augustus, who, you know, didn't avoid the name, but was effectively a military dictator. He's in charge because he controls the army, and he's going to make very sure that nobody else gets to control the army. The men who be the great conquerors were also the leaders in the civil war. And this is one of the reasons why after Augustus, successive emperors that follow very rarely conquer anything. Britain under Claudius is one of the rare exceptions. The Emperor Trajan in the early second century will conquer Dacia, modern day Romania, try to make some conquests in the east. Most emperors don't like conquest because they've got a choice. Either they go off and lead the conquest on their own, which is a bit risky because you might get killed. It also takes you away from Rome for years on end, which means it's much harder to govern the rest of the empire. And what's going to happen in your absence? Are some senators going to get ideas about supplanting you? On the other hand, if you don't go in person and you give a Roman senator command of the army to go and conquer things, he's got an army he'll make loyal to him. He's going to win glory. He's going to win fame. He's going to win money. He could easily become the next Julius Caesar, the next Pompey, the next rival to you. So politically, the empire really doesn't, you know, the emperors just don't like expansion, and it pretty much stops from AD 14. It helps that Augustus's successor, Tiberius, has already won so much military glory fighting on behalf of Augustus that he doesn't need to prove himself anymore, and he's really too old to care. Later emperors like Caligula, like Nero, aren't really interested in expansion. They prefer to stay in Rome or Italy. Claudius, who is made emperor when Caligula's just been murdered hours before, and the Praetorian Guard, the emperor's bodyguard, who need an emperor, any emperor, because otherwise they're not going to be anybody's guard. They're not going to be able to justify their high salaries, their comfortable lifestyle in Rome, find the emperor's uncle, Claudius, hiding behind a curtain in the imperial palace. Now, Claudius limps, he drools, he stammers. You know, you can think back to the old Robert Graves' I, Claudius, in the BBC drama. He's had no public career. People have wondered whether he was, you know, mentally unstable. He's got no military glory, and he's been made emperor in this very unconvincing situation where the guardsmen just proclaim him emperor because they need somebody. Probably no coincidence that he's the one that conquers Britain because he needs military glory. And then when the Emperor Trajan starts his conquest in the second century, he's been made emperor in circumstances after the murder of Domitian, and then Domitian's replaced by Nerva, an elderly senator who's sort of there as nobody's really got too much against him. It's deeply insecure. He adopts Trajan. Trajan has gone down in history as a great soldier, but up until that point that he becomes emperor, he hadn't really had much military experience at all. He didn't have any victories to boast about. So again, he goes off to try and unite the empire behind him through conquest. So you get these periodic bursts when, for political reasons, an emperor needs glory, the empire expands. But otherwise, it's really too dangerous for most emperors to risk it. There's also the factor that, rather like, you know, when they get to northern Britain, they look at what's outside the empire and think, well, really, financially, this is just not worth conquering. It's going to be difficult to do it because the locals are stubborn, they're determined, they're going to resist us, we're going to have spend on a big garrison, we'll probably be here for years and years, and what are we going to get in return? So there's always that balance between the two, but on the whole, things are discouraging emperors from expansion. And by the 3rd century AD, when civil war becomes so common, most emperors have got so many other things that are occupying their mind to survive, to fight against other Roman rivals, that there really isn't the energy, isn't the enthusiasm for conquest, and it simply stops. But even then, very little of the empire is lost until much, much later.
I may be reading way too much into this, but I can't help but also think about, as we talk about the expansion of the Roman Empire really happening, why we would still consider Rome to be a republic. And we won't get too much into this, but whether or not, you know, some people say it's a mixed form of government, had elements of democracy, but not a full-fledged democracy. But I can't help but also think about ancient Athens and the Athenian Empire that also spread while it was a democracy itself.
It's one of those strange things about the ancient world is that the democracies do tend to be very aggressive, particularly the big ones. In part because often the voters can see a benefit from this, and certainly the political class can see, especially in Rome, the opportunities for glory, for profit. It's one of the ironies that as far as the wider provincial population were concerned, the creation of the empire and the rule of emperors was a really good thing. Because under the Republic, it was very difficult to protest against abuse by a governor. You had to send an embassy to Rome, wait for a senator to take up their case, then for the senator to raise that in the Senate, and then maybe at a later stage to bring a prosecution against that governor. You've got these cases where men are using the money they've extorted from the provincials to bribe everyone to make sure this doesn't happen. Once you've got emperors, then anyone in the province believes that they can actually go to that emperor, and it might take years, they might have to queue up, but the emperor will listen to their problem. They know who it is they have to make a complaint to. And there's a marvelous story from the Greek geographer Strabo writing in the early 1st century AD, where he talks about some islands off the coast of Greece that are so poor that their entire tax income for 1 year of the entire island is actually less than the value of a milk cow that we happen to know about from a nearly contemporary papyrus from Egypt. But a representative of these fishing villages comes on board the ship Strabo's traveling on past the island to go to the Emperor Augustus at Corinth and to wait his turn to ask to have their tax reduced. They can't even afford this, is the argument. Now, that man clearly believes, as do the communities that have sent him, that the emperor will eventually find the time to deal with their problem and will be sympathetic. There's the expectation that they'll actually, you know, they've got a fair chance of getting a good answer. And this is the pattern all the way through. You get the abuse of power by men like the procurator who's, you know, provoked Boudicca into rebellion. But it's much, much harder to get away with it under the empire because the emperors don't want trouble. You know, it was much, there's some telling letters from the orator Cicero, who governed Cilicia in southern Turkey now in the first century, where his predecessor had stolen money wherever he could get it. He'd extorted money from the cities for all sorts of pretexts, behaved like a wild beast. In his private letters to friends, Cicero says how awful this is, how absolutely terrible, the man's a monster. We also have Cicero's letters to the man himself, his predecessor, which are very, very polite, very restrained. There's the occasional sort of veiled criticism. But Cicero knew that this man was one of the most influential aristocrats in the Senate, and that for the rest of his life, he's going to have to sit next to this man and debate things with him. He doesn't want to upset him. So political influence, if you belong to the right family, if you had the right friends in Rome, you could get away with a huge amount under the Republic. You couldn't do that under the emperor because the emperor doesn't want that sort of behavior by his governors, because if it happens, you tend to end up, same result you have with Boudicca, you get a rebellion, and the emperor doesn't want rebellions. So it's an odd thing that, you know, almost is counterintuitive to us, but the end of democracy at Rome in any meaningful way is actually a lot better for the wider provincial population, in part because in the last few generations of the Republic, the aristocracy had so abused its power and so ignored serious problems because it was so busy with its own competition, its own infighting, that it hadn't dealt with things. So it's strange, but in the same way you get, you know, the assembly, the People's Assembly in Athens would often vote for very extreme, rather savage measures, was extremely willing to be aggressive, to attack people because they saw benefits to it. You know, we'd expect them to be a lot calmer, a lot nicer, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
I'm going to take a quick time out here. I have two more questions, but I want to make sure I respect your time because we were a little bit over time that we told you. Are you okay?
I'm okay, yep. If that's all. Just have a quick drink there, that's all.
Yeah, take that drink. Tell me when you're ready.
There we go.
All right, and thank you. And we'll just maybe be 10 more minutes. Are you okay with that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
okay,
fine.
Great. Here we go. Let me jump back into this. 3, 2, 1. We are speaking to Adrian Goldsworthy. He is a historian of the classical world. He's the author of the book, Hadrian's Wall. So it's called Hadrian's Wall. This is after the Emperor Hadrian. Who was Hadrian?
Hadrian's quite interesting because he's an emperor from Spain. He's the second one. Trajan, his predecessor, was also from Italica in Spain. But they're Roman citizens. And, you know, as far as the Romans are concerned, they're just as Roman as anybody else. And it's part of that trend. Later in the second century, you'll have the Emperor Septimius Severus, who come from North Africa. And he's the Roman Emperor, but he's also a Roman citizen. Nobody ever comments at all on his appearance. There are a few snide comments we get about Hadrian having a rather provincial Spanish accent to his Latin. But in every other respect, he's considered to be just as Roman as everyone else. He wasn't a terribly popular emperor. He, in part because of his personality, he does seem to be one of those men who was very clever, very capable, but liked showing off and always liked to have the last word. And of course, you know, if you're emperor, you can get away with that, but it means people don't like you. It's also the circumstances when he became emperor were a little bit unusual in that it wasn't clear the Emperor Trajan had adopted him before he died. He orders the execution, or at least some leading senators are executed shortly afterwards. The emperor Hadrian is probably the man who gave the order. So he's never liked by the Senate. And it's made worse in that Hadrian is the first emperor to wear a beard and to be overtly Greek. You know, he was obsessed with Greek philosophy, Greek ideas. He actually became a magistrate in Athens while he was emperor. Now, people had done that before they were emperor, but not at the same time. And, you know, a lot of what you see, a lot of the archaeology you see in Athens today was built by Hadrian. He even set up an arch in which he proclaimed, this is the city of Hadrian, not the city of Theseus. You know, Theseus, the mythical founder of Athens. So he likes to sort of see himself as this very sophisticated Greco-Roman intelligent man, a little bit different. But he also has affairs with young men, particularly Antinous, this youth he watches. He's sort of supposed to be visiting this gymnasium and seeing the youngsters, the young men performing. And he falls in love with this fella. And then has, you know, the Romans didn't really mind what people did privately, but publicly for the emperor to have an affair with a boy or a youth is considered, particularly the extent to which Hadrian paraded it. You know, there are loads of images of Antinous. When Antinous dies under slightly mysterious circumstances, drowning in Egypt, and he founds a whole city named after him, it's all seen as, you know, a little bit too much for decent Roman behavior, if you can use such a thing. So it combines, probably if Hadrian had been popular in other respects, he could have got away with that and people would have still liked him. But because they didn't like him in the first place, you have this sort of snowball effect. Anything someone then does will be that much more annoying to all the people who already don't like him. He also abandoned some of Trajan's conquered territory in the east. So that's a big change. That seems a little bit shameful. But he is a very active emperor. Compared to everybody back as far as Augustus, he is the only emperor who starts to travel anywhere near as much as Augustus and spends most of his reign visiting virtually every province of the empire, including Britain. Comes to Britain in 122. He likes building things. He's obsessed with architecture. So there's probably something of the stamp of Hadrian on the wall that the Romans called the Vallum Aelium, the wall of Aelius was Hadrian's family name. you know, the reason it's so big, it's on such a grand scale compared to all the other frontiers of the Roman Empire, there's nothing as elaborate as this. Probably has a lot to do with Hadrian. On the other hand, you know, what he built tended to be practical. You've only got to go to the Pantheon in Rome today, you know, which later turned into a church, where you could still walk under that huge dome ceiling. And it's an incredible building. You know, that was Hadrian's design, one of Hadrian's projects. His villa at Tivoli is this sort of incredible extravaganza of all the different sort of glimpses of all over the empire. So, yes, he likes his grand projects, but they also tend to be quite well thought out, quite practical. So there is probably a lot of the personal stamp of Hadrian on Britain. And he was the first emperor to come to Britain since Claudius had come very, very briefly for about 10 days after the initial conquest in AD 43. So, you know, it's part of his tour of the empire, but it also shows a practical interest in getting the empire to work, making the frontiers work, in showing himself to the army, doing all these sorts of things. So he's an interesting man, but again, not quite as bad as the nature of the wall itself, but we don't have very good sources for Hadrian. Even though he's important, even though his images are quite common, the literary sources for the second century AD are extremely poor, which means that we're relying on the sort of accounts written centuries later that we'd normally prefer to avoid, but there is simply nothing better. So trying to get to the real Hadrian is as difficult as it is almost anybody else in the Roman world.
Yet he's considered one of the, I think, five emperors that spanned this Pax Romana period, the Roman peace, considered the golden era of the Roman
Empire.
He's
singled out by Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire as one of the five good emperors that, again, and it is abundantly clear that most of the greatest monuments of the wider Roman Empire, not necessarily Rome itself, though there are some there like the Pantheon, but many of the other big monuments are built in this period. The empire seems particularly prosperous in the second century. It probably has a bigger population than at any other point. You know, you can look back even to, it's a bit two-edged, but there was the analysis of samples from the polar ice caps a few years ago that found that in the first and particularly the second century AD, there was more industrial activity and hence more pollution at this period of the height of the Roman Empire than there would be again until the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, they were even capable, or it shows how much human activity is going on, even if some of it's having an adverse effect. So the empire is prosperous, it's stable, it has a period where there's no threat of civil war, and Hadrian, you know, is probably a very good ruler, but as I say, he just didn't have that sort of personality that could make people like him. And the Senate even thinks twice about deifying him after his death, which was the normal mark of sort of, you approved of somebody's reign, you showed they were a good emperor by proclaiming they were a god as soon as they died. Hadrian's successor, Antoninus Pius, has to force the Senate to do this because they initially weren't too keen, but as soon as they see his successor wants this, then okay, fair enough, yes, we'll do it. So yes, I mean, he's a mixed figure. One suspects he was, you know, a very good ruler, as were most of them within the circumstance of the Roman Empire. And certainly this is a period of great prosperity, and it's before the Antonine plagues, and it's before the civil wars of the third century onwards. But we'd love to know more about what was really going on and have more of a sense of why he's doing a lot of what he's doing in the various provinces he visits.
Adrian Goldsworthy has been our guest. Again, Adrian Goldsworthy is a renowned historian of the classical world. He's the author of a number of books. He has joined us to talk about his latest. It's called Hadrian's Wall. Adrian Goldsworthy, I've enjoyed our conversation a great deal, and I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been fun.